This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 17th of June 2013 on Monocle 24. Culture is brought to you in association with Paradores de España. Hello and welcome to the 88th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. This week we're shooting from the hip with art, singing in a language that's not often pop's first choice, and hanging with a couple of cats that always cause a little creative trouble when they rock up to town. Take my hand, listening several, and first, come to the daddy of art fairs in an unassuming enclave. That'll be Art Basel.
I knew that I wanted to do an apartment that would be activated not only by the customer, but also by the musicians, the bartenders, the waitresses, that we're all creating the space and that it becomes more of an experiment.
We'll head to the middle of the map to meet the singer who's causing a sensation of a stir of a pop moment. We sing along with Arab Idol.
For them, he's that person that they've always heard about, but he's there, like physically, and they can relate to him.
And we meet the artist and curator duo Elm Green and Dragset, who are mixing it up and fixing it up in formerly Safer's Houses Munich.
When you put something in public space, is that anything can happen.
Yeah.
You know, it can be like kids tagging in a night, or people getting aggressive, or people not understanding that this is an artwork and drive straight into it.
Plus, we'll sit down with music producer and musician John Hopkins to hear about his new album. We'll celebrate 10 years of the arts and crafts record label in Toronto, and we'll welcome Finland's finest Husky Rescue from Midori House Session. Yep, we're packing it all in here like sardines on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. So before we head to Basel, first we'll kick things off with a recent visitor from Helsinki. Husky Rescue are a band of contradictions, sat somewhere between the dusty, countrified beginnings of their first album in 2004 and a continually evolving sound that now tiptoes somewhere closer to rhythmic, yet still creakily analogue pop, as found on new release, The Long Lost Friend. They're also not completely finished, with the band's lineup now including Swedish and British passports. Well, the new album is just out and we wanted to find out more, so we invited them into Midori House for a session, and first up, here they are with Treehouse.
Långt bort hemifrån, långt bort hemifrån, långt bort hemifrån, långt bort hemifrån. Counting down to when we all get round, we build a fine tree house up in the pine. We build two floors, I found some 2x4s, a ladder made of rope should do just fine. Stolen plywood makes a good ridge roof, a coat of paint and a tree house shines. Lay cardboard carpets, wrap ourselves in blankets, light up candles and stay up all night. So clap your hands together, make beats we can't believe. Cartwheels for melody, pillow fights in harmony. This is us together, right where I want to be. Hardships are history, and I swear you never leave. So clap your hands together, make beats we can't believe. Cartwheels for melody, love fights in harmony. This is us together, right where I want to be. Hardships are history, and I swear you never leave. All united, everyone's invited. House warming, party in the pines. Folks admire, we're proud but tired. We're serving fresh cupcakes and chai. Bonfire places light up friendly faces, all having the time of our life. Forget curfews, we are the chosen few, for all the days are longer than the night. So clap your hands together, make beats with Capri, cartwheels for melody, we love fighting harmony. This is us together, right where I want to be. Hardships are history, and I swear you'll never leave. So clap your hands together, make beats with Capri, cartwheels for melody, we love fighting harmony. This is us together, right where I want to be. Hardships are history, and I swear you'll never leave.
That was Husky Rescue doing Treehouse from the new record, and we'll be hearing more from them a little later on in the show. This is Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We're now, it's time for some art. Yeah, art's big brother house opens its doors in the place it's named for, Art Basel in Basel. What a difference a month makes. It's not May in Asia, so this isn't Art Basel Hong Kong, and it's not December in Florida, so it's not Art Basel Miami Beach. We're on Terra Svizzera. We're at Basel's Messeplatz for the homecoming of the monolith. The biggest art fair in the world feels full of work and couples in jackets and sneakers and famous faces. Oh, there's Leo DiCaprio. Ah, there's Michael Ballack. And full of gallerists doing their thing, searching for the collecting big guns in the crowd, saying hi, hoping their gear's getting some bat-lashed looks. Quick, tell me, what are the trends? Abstract art, baby. Figurative? Forget it. Joseph Kotuth at Sean Kelly, Anish Kapoor's quiet sculptural wall pieces at Listen, Donald Judd at David Zwirner. And it felt big this year. Were more people looking at maps? Maybe it was just me. Lots of things sold for lots of money, but we're going to take a different tack and look at what else there was at the fair. Lots of galleries were showing work by just one artist, taking a commercial risk to put all their art eggs in one basket of a booth. It's a curatorial thing. Just ask Alexander Gray, a gallerist with a track record of solo shows, intellectual rigour, presenting the unusual. Who'd have thunk it at an art fair?
The feature section is focused on curated exhibitions of artists or movements that haven't had a very visible place in the market. We are showcasing the work of Joan Semmel, a seminal figure from the 1970s who was a key figure in the development of feminist art in New York and in America. She's not shown in the U.S. We're excited to show work from the early 70s to the present. We're celebrating her 80th birthday, so it's an especially exciting moment to be celebrating that for her, with early works that dealt with eroticism, pornography, and representation of women's sexuality from a female perspective, and bringing up to work that from this year and recent years where she's dealing with other images of women that we don't see in popular culture and in art history, the aging female body.
This is something that we don't normally see at a fair, and I mean, this is something that's maybe lacking on museum walls in the USA, possibly, but certainly in an art fair. It must be nice to be able to hang such a, I wouldn't use the word challenging show, but such an honest show, right?
It's an honest show in that we're looking at recent art history and hopefully revising the story a little bit. I think, you know, one of the things about the contemporary art market and the contemporary art world is there's so much, and, you know, we kind of feel like everything has been done before, is being, you know, repeated. And when we look back at recent art history, and, you know, to even say art history when we're talking about a 30-year span feels completely insane, especially in a place like Basel, which has such rich museums where we can really look back centuries. But here, you know, we really have the opportunity to retell a story, to fill in gaps. And those gaps, you know, women are a gap, artists of color are a gap, geographic areas are a gap. So this is the opportunity that that exists here in this kind of platform where there can be this kind of diversity in place. What's so special about the Art Basel Fair is that it's also a market of ideas and a market of stories. And, you know, people come to this fair wanting to discover new things or rediscover things that they haven't thought about or looked at for a while. And that's what's very specific about Basel as a fair. And, you know, in terms of the market, absolutely. I mean, this is a place where we come to learn and we come to apply value, and value plays a really big role in any kind of market, but certainly in the art market.
While the contemporary and modern sold like correspondingly warm baked goods at the fair, next door Art Basel's Art Unlimited, a huge structure full of big conceptual art, was another chance for galleries to make a big statement. One of the most absorbing bits was Colombian Mateo Lopez's Casa Desorientada, something you might buy if you're a museum, but not if you're someone with a spare bit of sitting room to fill.
I'm Catalina Casas, the director of Casas Regner Gallery. We're a gallery based in Bogota. We represent mostly Colombian artists.
One of the most confusing and nicest things that we found is Mateo Lopez's house. This is a house within the Mesaplatz. It's a very sort of homely place in the sort of concrete confines of the Mesaplatz here in Basel. Maybe you can tell us what we're looking at right now and about Mateo's work.
Well, this is a project that was done specifically for the fair. Quite an ambitious project. It's called the Disoriented House, and it's a house where is kind of a utopic studio for the artist, and it's supposed to float. I don't know if you are aware of this, but it's a house that's supposed to float.
So, and it's made it's made of wood, certainly, and it's a kind of huge cube structure, sort of set at an angle to everything else in the fair here and in the room here. And I don't know if it's made of balsa wood. But it's made of, it's designed to bob about in a lake, on the sea, where?
No, not on the sea, because the salt will damage the structure. It has to be a lake or a river, and we actually have already built the float. We just didn't bring it, it wouldn't fit. We hardly fit inside this booth. But it had to do with the idea of the artist of being able to inhabit somewhere that wasn't attached to the land.
And it'd be interesting to know about who you're aiming to meet this week at Basel. This seems very much like the kind of piece that's attracting curators and museums rather than collectors. This kind of thing doesn't sit over anybody's mantelpiece in a very friendly way, right?
Yeah, most definitely. We're trying to look for a home for this house in a museum. And it has to be also somebody very ambitious that will collaborate with us in making it float.
And how does it work? I mean, we always hear about the sort of new power of South American money and collectors in the art world. Is this a very nice to bring such a sort of strong statement to a big fair like Art Basel?
As to collectors, I wish we had more. It's not that strong. We're still an emerging plaza, I guess, because there are not very many collectors. And so we actually are looking for collectors outside. Part of the program of the gallery is doing a lot of fairs, because that's the way we can make it happen. Otherwise, if we would only count on our local collectors, there'd be no house.
Out and about in town, New York-based artist Micheline Thomas, with the help of Absolute's Art Bar, kept the drinks flowing in conceptual style. Her installation, called Better Days, took a Brooklyn house party from the 1970s and transformed it. US electrical sockets, wood paneling, funky sound system and all, and recreated it in bourgeois Basel's Kunsthaus. Chin Chin.
I was actually quite excited when I was invited to do this project, because when Absolute approached me, I knew exactly what I want to do. I said, yes, I know exactly which way to go. And I knew that I wanted to do an apartment that would be activated not only by the customer, but also by the musicians, the DJ, the bartenders, the waitresses, that we're all creating the space, and that it becomes more of an experiment. It's taken, to just go back a little, Better Days comes from the concept of particular parties my mother used to throw with her friends back in the 70s, late 70s, to raise money for sickle cell anemia.
Okay.
And so they would also have these parties in conjunction with fashion shows and theatrical plays for these charities that they would sort of raise money for. And they named their group Better Days. And so for me, I wanted to sort of have this sort of homage to my mother, since she just passed, to have her sort of be a part of this sort of experiment, this project, by looking at sort of how she created these spaces with her friends. And since I had the opportunity to create this space, I sort of also brought all of my friends that are artists, that all of the DJs that I bought are DJs that I respect and that I love their work. And so it was easy to handpick people for this project.
But there's an element of your mum's front room that you brought to Basel here, and it's an art fair. There's a lot of commercial elements going on. There's a lot of undercurrents. There's a lot of overcurrents going on. But this is you've brought a kind of bit of home to the Swiss Hills as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, it's like, you know, we have great art fairs going on. There's a fantastic art behind the convention walls, but I think this is a different sort of art piece. I think this is an art piece where those behind the convention walls, after you leave sort of that environment, you come into sort of the bourgeois Switzerland, you walk down the street, and then you want to, maybe you want to just plug in your American iPhone because you left your adapter at home. We have rewired our outlets and better days for Americans to plug in their iPhones.
This is the lost souls from New York City, right?
Lost souls from New York City are anywhere where you share the same outlet. So don't be shy and you can enjoy a great cocktail.
And there we sort of are. There's so much at Basel that would kill you to try and squeeze into a radio spot. But this year we took away museum-grade work, abstraction in paint, big ideas, a little performance, the stuff not for sale and the stuff that was sang in harmony, and the Swiss sun shone on the art world's half-season break in its buying and showing marathon. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where from the world of the art market in Basel, we head eastwards now to soak up a bit of pop culture. A young Palestinian from the beleaguered Gaza Strip has become an overnight musical sensation in the Arab world. His name is Mohammed Asaf, and his powerful singing has been dominating the hit Friday evening TV programme Arab Idol. Though he nearly missed his own audition, his performances are now engendering an unlikely spirit of reconciliation between Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, as Monocle's Joseph Dana reports from Ramallah.
For the past several weeks, downtown Ramallah has transformed from a bustling city center to a musical carnival on Friday evenings. Plastic chairs line the city streets as every vendor in town rushes to offer their selection of grilled meats and falafel sandwiches to the eager crowds. Entire families mill about, waiting for 9 o'clock to roll around and for Palestinian singing sensation Mohammed Asaf to take to the stage on Arab Idol, broadcast from Beirut. For Rami, a local shopkeeper, Mohammed Asaf's popularity is not just about his musical talent. He is helping to mend internal Palestinian divisions.
He is one of the most popular singers nowadays, you know. Their feeling or their perception about him that he is one of the most amazing singers, you know, in Palestine and in the whole of the Arabic world. He's like one of the last hopes, you know, that maybe he will be the main bridge, you know, like for connecting the main two parts of Palestine, West Bank and Gaza.
Mohammed Asaf barely looks his 23 years. He is one of 7 children from Khan Yunis in the Gaza Strip. With a contagious smile he can barely contain on stage, Asaf has wooed Arab Idol with passionate renditions of classic Arabic songs, all the while draped in a traditional Palestinian keffiyeh. Dalia Hatouka is a Palestinian journalist based in Ramallah. I asked her why his stardom has taken Palestine by storm.
If anything, it just speaks to the fact that Palestinians are really angry, they're frustrated, they feel like there's not much hope out there. And in a sense, this young man just came out of nowhere. He just burst into the limelight. He basically unified everybody across like political, economic, cultural spectrums. And he's managed to unify all these Palestinians because he represents something that's unattainable, which is somebody to believe in.
As a man under the age of 40, Asaf must coordinate his travel with Egyptian authorities in order to leave Gaza. The process almost cost him a spot in Arab Idol. Due to border troubles, Asaf arrived at the Cairo Hotel, where the auditions were being held, as the judges were already packing up. After being informed that all contestant slots had already been filled, the exhausted Asaf promptly burst into song and convinced the judges to give him a shot.
Allah.
Gaza and the West Bank have been physically severed since militant Islamic group Hamas took over the Gaza Strip in 2006. Restrictions on movement for Palestinians traveling between the two territories have further entrenched political divisions. Asaf's universal embrace by Palestinians has also helped connect Palestinians with the rest of the Arab world. Dalia Hatouka, again.
For the Arabs, Mohammed Asaf represents as close as they can get to Palestine. He's there, he's firing them up with all these songs about Jerusalem, about refugees, about this, about that, and all these things. I mean, these things unify Arabs. It's hard for you to even meet an average Palestinian in Lebanon from Palestine itself, because a Palestinian from the Gaza Strip or the West Bank has a huge difficulty in coming to Beirut, let alone being there with so many Arabs from places like Syria, Morocco, Egypt, Iraq, Saudi. For them, he's that person that they've always heard about, but he's there, like, physically, and they can relate to him because they've been reading and hearing about him their whole lives.
From Fayrouz in Lebanon to Umm Kulthum in Egypt, powerful, often female singers have come to define modern Arab music. Their songs, sometimes laced with nationalist overtones, are permanent features of cafes and cabs from Tunis to Baghdad. The last 10 years has seen an explosion of satellite channels, which have broken down national boundaries across the Arab world. Almost impossibly, these two factors have collided with the successful import of American Idol to the Arab world. The show has come to typify Friday nights, and Mohammed Asaf's popularity in the program are leading people like Ali, a Ramallah shopkeeper, to see the beginnings of a cultural revolution. Mohammed Asaf came out of the ruins in Gaza, Ali says. A very modest background, but it represents all Palestinians. As Yasser Arafat said, revolutions do not come with weapons, they also come from the culture. Many people you speak with in Palestine these days say that Mohammed Asaf is more popular than any political leader. It is a lot of responsibility for this young man from Gaza, but he appears to be handling it well, never letting that smile leave his lips. Whether or not Asaf is crowned the next Arab Idol on the 21st of June seems like an afterthought for many here. And for the time being, Friday nights in Palestine are welcome spaces of festive Palestinian artistic expression and unity that extends beyond politics. For Monocle, in Ramallah, I'm Joseph Dana.
And if you're in the Middle East, the grand final of Arab Idol takes place this Friday, 21st of June, on MBC One. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We'll be coming back to London next to meet John Hopkins.
Awaken in a 15th century castle, stroll through majestic medieval palaces, or enjoy the silence that reigns within the walls of former convents and monasteries. Select from 94 unique locations and explore Paradores de España for much less than you might imagine. Visit paradores.com and begin your trip today.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Musician John Hopkins is a man of many musical hats. He's composed soundtracks from the lo-fi indie hit Monsters to Peter Jackson's version of The Lovely Bones with Brian Eno. He's worked with Coldplay, producing and composing on their last two albums. He's played live across the world from huge festivals in Asia to the tiny but influential LA club Low End Theory. He's been nominated for a Mercury Prize for his album with Scottish folk artist King Creosote, and he's even dabbled in the world of contemporary dance, composing, not dancing. On Immunity, his fourth solo album, he veers from the lush ambient textures he made his name with to a tougher yet still emotional techno sound. Monocle's Paul Noble asked him if Immunity, inspired by the arc of an epic night out, was, brace yourself, a concept album.
I never really have an idea until I've actually, like, the actual point at which I start writing is usually based on what instruments I've got around me and what mood I'm in. And then about halfway through, I start to realise that there might actually be a point to it all. And at that point, I start jumping on that and trying to guide it in some direction.
One of the themes we find is that music production, particularly with electronic music, has become very easy. There's programs, there's presets. You can put together a track very quickly. Mm. Immunity feels very human and very emotional, and you can really feel the human touch in it. How do you manage that? How do you accomplish that?
I spend quite a lot of time making sounds with things around me and refusing to use the shortcuts that are offered, really. I mean, there's nothing wrong with... I love a lot of stuff that's made really quickly. I kind of wish I could do it, really, but it takes me ages to build something that I personally would want to listen to a lot of times. And I really like the idea of trying to make something that will still sound interesting in a few years and isn't tied to any particular time or genre. With this album, I didn't really allow myself to use any drum samples, so instead of picking the same kind of patches as you hear all over the place, I actually just would hit things around the studio with other things and record the sounds and sequence them up and just try and build stuff out of physical items, really, and just try and give the album a sense of dimension of some sort.
You're a pianist and you're a very talented piano player. You're using the piano on this album in all sorts of different ways.
Yeah, I mean, I really like the fact that it makes all these noises that it's not supposed to. I mean, I've had the same piano since I was 9, I think, and it's a little bit knackered now. And the pedal makes this creaking noise, and that sound I've been hearing since I was 9, and it's become completely bound with that piano for me. And every time the piano tuner comes, he offers to fix it, but I actually say no because I love it, and it helps make up the beat in the title track, Immunity, which you can hear, that kind of clunking wooden sound. It's all just the pedals. So I just like to include all the things that have become personal about the instruments around me, in, you know, rather than getting rid of the mistakes, almost amplifying them, because it just makes it more real to me, I guess.
Because you've been travelling quite a lot with your live show, is this around the world on a laptop or is this a studio-based?
Very much my studio, actually, yeah. This time I was very keen to carve out a period of time and do it all in London at my place. I got some analogue synths, so I can't really travel with them anyway, and they kind of form the backbone of a lot of the first half of the record. I also work with an engineer, so I kind of have people to help out with stuff. So yeah, and then there's very little I can do on the road with it, which is quite nice, because as soon as you, if you go away to do gigs or something, you can just leave it behind and get some perspective on it and come back to it later.
The album feels a lot more, there's a lot more dance floor, there's a lot more of a techno influence in this album. Some of your previous albums are quite relaxing, it's a sort of beautiful, lush listening. This one feels a bit more brutal. Where did that come from?
It's quite hard to tell, because I really do just work on instinct and just write what I feel like. But looking back at the last few years, when the ideas were forming, I was touring a lot my previous album, and there's some quite edgy moments on that, and it led me to be on a lot of different lineups with quite techno-ish artists, and so I guess I got kind of inspired by the things I was hearing. And also, if you spend time travelling around the world, you have a lot of time to think about the state of things, and you do find yourself going down some slightly dark alleyways, and it's kind of interesting to try and explore that in the music a bit.
For those listening to the album and picking it up in the next few weeks, can we use the phrase concept album? Is that acceptable?
I always try and write something that has a narrative arc from start to finish, and if that makes it a concept album, then so be it.
And it all seems to me to lead up to Collider, which is a sort of banging beast of a track. Did you always envision the album that way?
I did, but I didn't know what that track was going to be, so I love there to be a centrepiece. I love there to be one real focal moment, and it is definitely the most serious thing on there. And when it was written, I think it was a 2-week period where I hardly slept, and I was just really going for it with that track. And yeah, I mean, it's a fairly oppressive listen. It's got one solitary bass pulse kind of pounding really heavily for 10 minutes.
That was John Hopkins talking to Paul Noble there. John's new album, Immunity, is out now on Domino Records, and he's playing dates all over Europe this summer. Just visit johnhopkins.co.uk for more details. Still to come in part two, we'll hear some more of that fabulous Finnish Fun Fest with more of that wonderful Midori House session from Husky Rescue. We'll hear what happened when the city of Munich let artists Elmgreen and Drag set loose on their streets. And we'll celebrate a decade of Toronto's Arts and Crafts record label. What more could you desire than our montage of music and art? I ask you. So first, back to Marco, Johanna and Anthony, aka Husky Rescue, for some more of their Midori House session. First up, their track River, and then Monocle's Tom Hall spoke to the trio to try to get to the bottom of all their apparent contradictions.
Go with river, flow downstream. Let go of the hold and see.
Am I right? You're the sort of founding member of the band, is that right?
Right.
And then it's a kind of international crew. We've got Johanna from Sweden, and Anthony, are you from the UK? Or?
I'm half British, half Finnish.
And I mean, it's obviously been a bit of a journey the way you guys came together. I mean, I know that the first album was very country influenced, is that right?
Was it country?
Well, this is the thing.
The name was only.
Yeah.
I think one of my friends, she described that. Yeah, he's actually recording some sort of winter country.
Yeah, right, like, as opposed to kind of like searing Texarkana. Kind of, yeah, guacamole country or something. But I mean, that sound has kind of developed over the years, and the stuff that you're playing at the moment, it's almost sort of a lot of it's quite electronic sounding. I mean, the first album had like electronic elements, didn't it? Like, I can hear that, but it definitely sounds a lot more almost dancey now. Is that something that you'd agree with?
Yes. Yeah. There's probably a few more danceable tracks on the new album, yeah.
I think it's a little bit too hard to dance because it's not so thriving.
Is that maybe a Finnish characteristic?
Because yeah, definitely.
We get told about this a lot from our resident Finn, Marcus Hippie. The Finns are kind of, not depressed, depressed is the wrong word, but we get told that maybe you have a slightly more, let's say, realistic outlook on life. Is that fair?
That's nicely put.
Well, as a Swede, I always dance in the studio while recording and listening to the tracks.
Yeah, I think the Swedes are completely different from
Yes, because life is easier for Swedes.
Yeah. And how do you find it, Anthony, being sort of half British, half Finn, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And are you able to dance at all?
Very, very rarely. Probably the fact that I'm half and half just makes me even more confused.
Yeah, the Brits are kind of awkward, aren't they?
Yeah.
And the new album, it's on El Camino Records, right?
Yes, our label.
Am I right in thinking that you're trying to bring across a bit more of a like sort of fan participation, or make it more of a package for fans with this new album, kind of doing bespoke jobs on the artwork and the vinyl and stuff like that.
It's actually interesting what happened to music industry. We are about to make friends with our fans. It's almost possible nowadays to know the people who have really bought the music.
And do you think that's important nowadays when, you know, everyone can, if they want, from whatever avenue they choose, they can maybe get your music for free if they wanted to be not quite honest about it?
Everyone could be. Yeah.
Do you think it's important now to have that relationship with fans and put it across that you've got a personal bond with them in some way? Is that something that you find is important?
It is definitely one of the fun parts of, let's say, touring, to talk to people, get to know them after the shows and so on.
Yeah. And do you find the playing live, do you prefer that to recording, or is it all kind of part of the same thing? Do you prefer the creativity of recording, or do you prefer the going out and meeting people of playing live?
I don't really think there's any preferable things, just things happening. Yeah.
When you had loads of gigs, then you're longing to write and record as well, to have time for that. And then when you're in the studio, you're longing for having gigs.
That was Husky Rescue talking to Tom Hall there. The band's album, The Long Lost Friend, was out in Scandinavia in April, but has just been let loose on the rest of the world this month. They've also got some live dates coming up in Europe later this year. Hop along to husky-rescue.com for more deets, cats. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. In light of what's currently happening in Turkey and beyond, the importance of public space has been a major talking point the past few weeks. But using public space as a forum, meeting point and identity maker doesn't always have to be directly political. It can also be artistic. The City of Munich's Department of Arts and Culture realised the importance of these issues and asked two Scandinavian artists from Berlin, Elmgreen and Dragsit, to explore them. The result, a kind of art safari through the city centre, which just opened in its entirety and will run through September this year. Monocle correspondent Kimberly Bradley takes a ride through Munich's newest outdoor cultural attractions, created by artists from around the world.
On Odeonsplatz in Munich, church bells strike noon. A man in an old-fashioned messenger outfit steps out onto the square. He walks across it, then slowly unlocks a glass vitrine containing a large silver megaphone. He takes out the megaphone, puts it to his mouth, and shouts,
"Es ist nie zu spät, sich zu entschuldigen!"
It's never too late to say sorry. It's a loaded statement to be shouting through a megaphone in Germany, certainly. Passersby try to interpret this performance sculpture by Elmgreen and Dragsit, the artist duo famous for their edgy narrative multimedia works, as well as for their recent fourth plinth sculpture on Trafalgar Square. With a 1.2 million euro budget and carte blanche, they could have filled the city with their own artwork. But instead, they curated artist friends to help explore the concept of public space, all in a city that Michael Elmgreen says has been timid about getting its art outdoors.
Munich has fantastic art institutions like Haus der Kunst, Kunstverein, Lienbachhaus, Pinakothek der Moderne. Amazing, strong contemporary art institutions, but all the fun happens behind closed doors. You have to enter to actually get the message. So when Munich asked us, it was to spice up their public space that is a little bit too maybe gentrified and polished, and get a little bit of grit in the well-functioning social machine.
On view are 17 stations, including sculptures, videos, interventions, performance, even a piece that passersby can smell.
And then you have very ephemeral works, like Sisson Solo's, like smells that just come down, and is a mix of roasted pork, beer, and Chanel No. 5 in a weird, disturbing mixture.
There's much more. Here on opening day, I and other art lovers set off in bicycle rickshaws for an art safari through central Munich. We pass a fake underground station entry by the late German artist Martin Kippenberger. Just across from the fancy Schumann's Tagesbar, a black screen by video artist Peter Weibu broadcasts live scenes of protest from the internet, and then goes black again. In front of the legendary Bayerische Hof Hotel is a monument decorated with balloons, plush toys, and pictures of a monkey. This is Bubblesplatz, a work by British artist David Shrigley, who's up for the Turner Prize this year.
A shrine to Bubbles, the chimpanzee, who used to belong to Michael Jackson. And the shrine is right next to a shrine to Michael Jackson himself. And I made the shrine to Bubbles in response to that. And I suppose it's deeply ironic, and a lot of the Michael Jackson fans are angry with me, but I think that's an interesting debate to have, and I think it's a worthwhile one.
We ride past a sign on a traffic island, reading Pay Nothing Until April. This is by American art legend Ed Ruscha. Then the replica of the fourth plinth by Irish-Chinese artist duo Stephen Hall and Lili Ren, later retrofitted as a one-room apartment. There's a marble monument by Icelandic artist Ragnar Kjartansson. I get into a rickshaw with Ingar Dragset and ask him about what happens to artwork when it enters the bigger world.
When you put something in public space, is that anything can happen. Yeah. You know, it can be like kids tagging in a night, or people getting aggressive, or people not understanding that this is an artwork and drive straight into it.
What has the general response been so far as you know?
In general, to the different projects, there's been like certain people that have taken it to their hearts, like with the Buddha, for instance, where the people working on the market, on the Viktualienmarkt, have sort of adopted the Buddha as their mascot, sort of, you know. So things like that is nice. And I think there's, in general, people seem very curious about the project.
We stop at a small church in the Glockenbachviertel and see a lovely sculpture by French artist Tatiana Touvé. It's a mattress, cast in bronze, draped over a clean plinth, dripping with water, acting as a fountain. The artworks are meant to be temporary and up until September 30th. One piece, however, a time capsule by artist Pauline Bastard from France and Ivan Argote from Colombia, is meant to remain for a long, long time.
The project is to make a time capsule for München. So we built this big rock, and now we are giving to people from Munich envelope, so they can send us a message, and all messages will be stored in this rock for 100 years, and in 2113 it will be shown somewhere in Munich in an exhibition.
Where will this rock be in this 100 years? Not, would it be right here on this square, or will it be elsewhere?
We're trying to negotiate it with the city, because it's not easy for them to decide like to where to put something for 100 years. We hope it's going to be in a park, hopefully in the English Garden. It's not very easy to do.
While most past public art was monumental, modern public art can add to a city's quality of life. It brings culture out of doors to a wider audience and can spur action and reaction in the general public.
When I first visited the shrine a few months ago, there was hardly anything on it, on the Michael Jackson shrine. It was really looking pretty sad and tired. But since I made the Bubbles shrine, the Michael Jackson shrine has really upped its game and is looking really quite lavish. So it's definitely, you know, wins the prize of the two shrines, you know. As soon as you start making an artwork in a public arena, it changes, and the context becomes half the work, quite often becomes more than half the work. The context is everything, really. And that's the nature of public artworks and the nature of this whole project of the space called Public. It's about dialogues and about conversations. And if you don't want to have those dialogues and conversations, then I guess you should keep your art in the gallery.
From Monocle in Munich, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
Thank you, Kim. And if you're in Munich this year, Elmgreen and Dragset's project, A Space Called Public, will be on in the city until the end of September. Just go to aspacecalledpublic.de for more details. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bowne, which means you're tuned into Monocle 24, where next we'll be celebrating one of Canada's finest independent record labels, reaching double digits. Stay tuned.
Discover a kingdom you will never want to leave, filled with so many unique experiences that a simple day is not enough to uncover them all. With 94 unique locations on offer, Paradores de España invites you to enjoy Spain at its finest, for much less than you might imagine. Visit paradores.com and begin your trip today.
Well, Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where to finish the show, today we're crossing to that mighty city of Toronto, where Arts and Crafts, one of Canada's biggest independent record labels, are celebrating their 10th anniversary. The label are home to such notable acts as Feist, Broken Social Scene, Cold Specs, Trust, and Dr. Mangan, to name just a few. They're going all out to celebrate this milestone with a pop-up photo exhibition, compilation releases, artist-designed t-shirts and e-book, and a series of free gigs at the inaugural one-day festival Field Trip in the heart of Toronto, which took place recently. It was attended by 10,000 fans, one of whom was Mar Sellers, our reporter, who caught up with some of the people behind Arts and Crafts to see just what makes this label tick.
Thank you very much, everybody.
I've never been to a festival before where the lineup is made solely of one independent label's roster. But Arts and Crafts isn't just any indie label, and this isn't just any festival. Field Trip is celebrating a milestone in the label's 10-year existence. The story starts in 2003, when label founder Jeffrey Remedios left his job at Virgin Records to start the company along with Broken Social Scene's Kevin Drew. Jeffrey on those early days.
Toronto was starting to look inwards a little bit more. People were supporting from within, and it was a really fun, fertile community. At the same time that the industry was going through an incredibly well-documented digital transformation, that was the climate I found myself working for a large corporation, uncertain of its future, when there was this really exciting, fertile excitement happening from an independent perspective. And so when they brought me into Dave Neufeld's Toronto studio to hear what was to become You Forgot It in People, and I was just in. I said, look, I'm not sure what I mean yet, but I think there's a way to do this, and I'd like to start a company around this.
Arts and Crafts and Broken Social Scene have been so intensely tied to each other since the beginning. Here's Broken Social Scene drummer Justin Paroff.
We made a record called You Forgot It in People, which essentially launched the label, and in turn, that release launched the band.
You know, Arts and Crafts started with Broken Social Scene at the core. The story's been well told, but Broken Social Scene is, you know, was a somewhat of a loose collective that turned into a proper band. But, you know, for the first couple of years of Arts and Crafts, we didn't have to think about A&R so much because we put out the records from our friends, which were related to Broken Social Scene. And, you know, I've often joked, like, you know what the key to success is? Like, start a company around Broken Social Scene. Because from them, they begat Jason Collette and Apostle of Hustle and Feist and Stars and sort of and on and on. And it was, we had a roster before we had to really think about building one.
What makes Arts and Crafts so special? Justin Paroff.
Well, initially, I feel they kind of set the trend of eliminating the middleman, in the sense that combining management and label in one company was unheard of, you know, 10, 12 years ago. Well, 10 years ago, we're celebrating the 10th anniversary this year. And that made it very different, but also it made a lot of sense. I feel like they really paved the trend, and now that seems to be the standard in the indie world.
And what about the other people who work with the label? Nadine Brendel is a European booking agent who started her agency, Moutique, the same year as Arts and Crafts, and has been working alongside the label in Europe from the beginning.
I've really admired how they started out, you know, working with their friends. And I guess they learned how to really run this business as they went along. And I've really, you know, I have huge respect for Jeffrey and Heidi and Kieran and everyone that works there. Like, they're so professional, but at the same time, they're so, you know, just friendly and open and just really fun to work with.
Former Canadian booking agent Eli Klein.
They have a really high degree of professionalism among their organization, from all aspects, from artist management to the label itself, to their productions. Obviously, Field Trip here being an Arts and Crafts production, you know, everything they do has a really strong aesthetic edge. And, you know, the sort of backbone of the label comes from a major label system, you see that sort of, you know, professional stride within them that is often missing from most indie collectives.
To celebrate their 10th anniversary, Arts and Crafts is collaborating across as many platforms as possible, with 2 compilation records, an ebook of short stories inspired by songs from You Forgot It in People, a Norman Wong photo exhibition, a Jeremy Lang fashion collaboration of a collection of t-shirts inspired by artists on the Arts and Crafts roster, and finally, Field Trip, the one-day festival in the heart of downtown Toronto, curated solely of Arts and Crafts artists and attended by 10,000 people. Jeffrey Remedios.
We wanted to honor Toronto, and we wanted to use this platform as for something that maybe hasn't happened here before, and, you know, kind of take some of the values of some of the great small festivals we've all been to around the world and throw a one-day event where we could have all of our artists play and bring all of these collaborators in and work with more collaborators like food vendors and craft beer vendors and craft wine vendors and on and on and on. And so we threw a music festival in Toronto called Field Trip. Cozy and
cold, put the horse before the car. After all this celebrating, what is the future for Broken Social Scene and Arts and Crafts? Justin Peroff.
We have zero plans. That wasn't even a plan to begin with. But as far as my relationship with Arts and Crafts, it will always be there. That's my family. I feel like we all watched each other grow up.
I mean, you know, I'll say this, like, I heard someone say a while ago something that I think really rings true for the success of Arts and Crafts, and that's if you want to be happy in life, like, you should, number one, do something you love, and number two, do it with your friends. And I can proudly say that's something I've gotten to do with Arts and Crafts.
I couldn't possibly end on any better advice. For Monocle in Toronto, I'm Mar Sellers.
Thank you, Mar. And if you're intrigued to learn more about this label or just want to buy some of that great music they've released over the last decade, just go to art-crafts.ca. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be attending Adland's biggest party, Cannes Lions, to hear what's changed in the last 60 years of the festival. And you've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilbao, and the show was woven together by the nimble-fingered Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week from their Midori House session. This is Husky Rescue with New Light of Tomorrow. Thanks, as ever, for tuning in.
Although the road we're on is narrow, along comes tomorrow. We're gonna see the sun, and in return for what I've borrowed, new light of tomorrow, we're gonna be as one. We're gonna be as one.